Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
I'm Contessa Brewer in for Brian Sullivan right now on Last Call. Beating back the shorts, the surprising reason why it's almost impossible to bet against Trump media stock. Breaking developments out of Reddit. A flurry of insider stock sales have just been disclosed. We'll bring them to you. Riding to the rescue, President Biden's reelection hopes get a boost from the economy. A truce in the Disney war. DeSantis makes peace with the Magic Kingdom. But a bigger battle looms. Defying the odds, Detroit's Big Three win big returns for investors. Plus, from sports betting to social betting, the gaming revolution takes a fresh turn. And does charging up pay off? A new report breaks down the real math behind owning an EV. We have all that and more over the next hour. Last Call is up right now. Let's kick off Last Call tonight with some breaking news. A short time ago, Fed Board Governor Christopher Waller made some significant comments at the Economic Club in New York City. His remarks come as the S&P 500 hit a record close today, and the Dow finished within striking distance of 40,000. CNBC's senior economics reporter Steve Leisman has been following Waller's speech and joins us now with more. What did you learn, Steve?
Yeah, Contessa, just real quick, I'm looking at the futures right now, and they're a little bit off of those highs after Waller started speaking. And the reason is because speaking at the Economic Club of New York, he gave a pretty hawkish remarks about the outlook for rate cuts, especially if you're looking for near-term rate cuts. He says recent strong economic data, as well as lack of progress in inflation, has reinforced his view that there's no rush to cut the policy rate. He says it's prudent to hold the rate at a restrictive level for, quote, longer than he previously thought, and he's not ready to cut until inflation progress materializes. It's appropriate to reduce the overall number of cuts or push them further into the future in response to the recent data. The risk of waiting a little longer to cut rates is significantly lower, he says, than the risk of acting too soon. He notes that the dot plot shows three cuts expected by the Fed, quote, but the dots have moved up, something we've been reporting for quite some time now. The committee says it's not overreacting to the data, but is not discounting it either. I think we have a bit of the sound of Fed Governor Waller talking at the Economic Club of New York. Let's give a listen.
In the absence of an unexpected and material deterioration in the real economy, I'm going to need to see at least a couple of months of better inflation data before I have enough confidence that beginning to cut rates will keep the economy on a path to 2% inflation.
On inflation, Waller said the progress has, quote, slowed and may have stalled. He's uncertain about the speed of continued progress on inflation right now because of the last 2 months of data we've had. He does not expect the February PCE, we get that number on Friday, it's the Fed's preferred inflation indicator, to show much progress towards 2% inflation. Waller says progress on inflation will be uneven, but he's still optimistic it's likely to continue down to 2%. He's not ruling out rate cuts. He still thinks inflation progress will make it appropriate for the Fed to cut rates this year. So I'll leave it there. He's upbeat on the economy. He's 2% growth. Actually calls it a remarkable economy. Oh, and just a couple other things here. He talked about the recent job gains. Let me just go to the very end here, guys, and tell you a couple other things that he said. He talked about the Baltimore boating accident, and he said that it was the accident was unlikely to have a major impact on the economy or inflation. He also said when it came to rate hikes, he says, we sort of joked, we'd have to see a very big change in inflation, Contessa, in order to reverse course or begin hiking rates. Leave it there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've got some of my own reporting there on the economic impact of the bridge collapse. We'll get to that a little bit later in Last Call. But in the meantime, Steve, if you'll stay with us, we want to get some reaction now from our leadoff panel. Joining us now is KBIC letter editor-in-chief Adam Kobasi and Hightower chief investment strategist, CNBC contributor Stephanie Link. It's good to have you joining in the conversation. Adam, is that about what you expected from Waller?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've been saying this now even on this show. The Fed would rather cut, you know, too late and risk slight economic weakness than cut too soon and risk a resurgence of inflation. Waller basically just said that word for word. And right now it's not clear. Was, you know, were the last couple of months of rising inflation data, were they a pothole, were they a speed bump? As Waller said directly, we don't know. We need to see more data before we can start cutting rates here.
CNBC has a survey of top investors here with the probabilities that this would happen. There you're seeing the probability of when rate cuts will happen. I want to show you how many times in 2024 these 400 or so top investors were surveyed by CNBC. It shows that 26% think that we'll get three rate cuts, 61% think we will get two rate cuts, and 13% think we'll get one rate cut. But nobody thinks we're going to get more than three, and nobody thinks we're going to get none at all. Stephanie, what's your view on how much of what Waller says is kind of already priced in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on the good news side, GDP is better than expected. And that's what Powell said last week, and that's definitely what Waller said tonight. And we understand that they are all waiting for inflation to make even more progress. Let's be real, though. We have made real progress. The CPI peaked at 9.1%, and we are now at 3.2. I know they look at core PCE, and we get that on Friday, but we are well below the 5.57% number in the peak for core PCE. Is that in the twos, two and a half, threes? But I don't know. We'll see on Friday. But we are definitely making progress. And then to your question about what do I see in terms of the Fed, what they're going to do, I don't even know if it's going to have a material impact, one or two or three, on the overall economy because we raised so much. It's really more just a signal for investors. It's a signal that they're starting to realize that we don't have to be this restrictive. And that's all very good news. One last point on inflation. We have seen home prices fall 6 months in a row, down 7.4% year over year. We know that rents follow home prices, and rents have been the sticky part of inflation. That is good news that home prices are coming down because I think that rents are going to be coming down in a couple of months' time.
You know, I was at an event last week with a former Atlanta Fed and Fed president and also the head of global fixed income for BlackRock. And one of the talking points was the fact that the people who are really getting hurt or who are feeling the pinch from high interest rates are small businesses and sort of the engine of the United States. When you're looking at this calculus, Steve, between inflation and the economic growth, did you get a sense for how much the Fed is weighing what's happening with small business owners?
I mean, I think that's part of the calculus. I mean, the Fed will tell you six ways to Sunday. They have only one rate, and that rate goes to the entire economy. And how the economy then parcels that out or lenders parcel out to other people, that's really up to them. I would point out, contestant, not to be a total Scrooge here, but remember during when rates were at zero, everybody complaining how seniors and people living on a fixed income were affected and they were badly hurt by it. So, you know, it's just one of those things that comes with the territory. The Fed is never going to be able to, I mean, I guess they could have individual administered rates. Maybe in this world of AI and computers, they can do that. But as far as I can tell, they have a single rate. They also have the balance sheet to cut. And here's the thing. The objective is to bring down inflation. And what they'll also, I think, tell you from the Fed is the best thing they can do for small business and for the overall economy is to bring down inflation.
And you heard from him that the job gains have been broad-based, that the strength of the job market indicates that demand is still there and really not moderating it enough. So Morgan Stanley Executive Chairman James Gorman weighed in on the debate over rate cuts. Here's what he said on Squawk on the Street yesterday.
I would not be totally shocked if they don't do anything for the rest of the year. I know the market's pricing now three rate increases versus six a couple of months ago. you know, the Fed has to ask, what's the benefit?
Adam, what do you think? Could we see that?
I mean, I think, look, I think rate cuts start this year. I think that's still going to happen. Do we see more than three? Definitely not. I think we could definitely see less than three, depending on what's going to happen. The Fed's going to keep doing this meeting-by-meeting approach. They're going to keep being data-dependent. But at the end of the day, I mean, we do see inflation is trending lower overall. We have had some hiccups, and that's expected. But I think we see some rate cuts this year, maybe two, maybe one. Three would be great, and markets are finally coming in line with what the Fed's saying. And then from there, you know, we got to make sure inflation's sustainably going to 2%. And then, you know, there's this notion that once you start cutting, you have to go in a straight line lower. No, you can cut, pause a little bit, cut more, and take it meeting by meeting like the Fed's been doing. And I think that would be the best way to handle this.
Adam, Stephanie, Steve, thank you all for joining me on this Wednesday night. Appreciate it. Let's take a look at studs and duds today. The biggest winner of the day, Enphase Energy, up 9.6% on a strong day broadly for solar stocks. The biggest loser, Arista Networks, down 3.2%. The SEC settled insider trading charges against one of its founders. Up next, a flurry of insider stock sales have just been disclosed by Reddit. We bring you the details. Plus, the Trump media shares are flying high yet again, and they just did something no other stock in the market can claim. Stay with us.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go. Give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Let's get to it. Tomorrow's news tonight and some new insider stock sales have just been disclosed by Reddit. The most notable coming from CEO Steve Huffman. He sold 500,000 shares on Monday, according to a new SEC filing. He now holds about 710,000 shares. Look at Reddit shares, down 5.3% in extended trading. Before investors lose their minds here, though, this was expected. Joining me for more is Ben Silverman, Vice President of Research with Verity. So you were looking at this. You expected the CEO to sell off 500,000 shares.
Thanks for having me on, Contessa. Yeah. So Huffman, the company had disclosed this in their prospectus, which was originally filed about 3 weeks ago. So it was known that he was going to sell some stock and it was going to be 500,000 shares. And he actually owns more than 4 million shares. Still, some of those are in the form of options. So this is a portion of his holdings.
Okay. So I also want to mention that Reddit COO Jennifer Wong disclosed a sale as well, 514,000 shares. And Wong holds 1.7 million shares of Reddit. Is there any disconnect for you between an IPO of a company like Reddit and senior executives? Their leadership has been out pumping the company, talking about the prospects for growth with them selling their shares, even if it was expected.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a bit of a disconnect because the purpose of bringing the company public is twofold. It's not just to generate liquidity for the company itself so that it can expand and grow. You know, in these situations, it's often to allow insiders to cash out and to generate some liquidity. And that's something investors have to consider here. If the prospects are so bright, you know, why are insiders selling? Now, for Huffman, one of the interesting angles here is he got a sweetheart stock award from the board last year that would pay him over 660,000 shares if the company can maintain a market cap of $5 billion or higher for like a 10 consecutive day period anytime between now and August. well, you know, the market cap now, even with the stock dropping like 11% today, was over $9 billion. So it wasn't a hard hurdle to hit. And assuming the stock doesn't just fall off a cliff over the next few days, he should hit that. So one thing to think about is he sold these 500,000 shares. He's getting all that stock. He's going to likely get all that stock back. So there's a corporate governance issue. And again, that's something for investors to think about, how this company's run.
Ben, appreciate you jumping on the phone with us tonight. Appreciate it. Let's move on to other big meme stocks right now. The Trump media hot streak is continuing. DJT up 14% in its second day of trading. If you include the pre-merger run by Digital World Acquisition, shares are now up 300% in the last 6 months. In fact, the stock is so hot, you literally cannot bet against it. According to data from S3 Partners, there are few shares to borrow, and the fees are astronomical. So remember, to short a stock, you need to first borrow the shares, and right now there are practically none to be had. Joining me for more, Wall Street Journal lead writer and CNBC contributor Gunjan Banerjee. It's really great to have you on here. Gunjan, give me an idea of why shorting this stock is so hard.
Thanks, Contessa. You're right. This has all the ingredients of a good old-fashioned meme stock rally. And one of those key ingredients is a stock that's tough to bet against and tough to borrow to bet against. And we're seeing that with this company right now. I will point out that one place people can bet against Donald Trump's social media company is through the options market, where we've seen activity totally explode there, hit some of the highest levels ever. And people are turning to some of those bets that would profit if the stock tanked, but also really bold, bullish bets that would profit if, you know, this thing kept going bananas as it has been this week.
You know, we've seen other meme stocks losing steam, so to speak, GME and AMC. How much more room could there be to run for a stock named on a wildly popular former president?
What we've seen is that it's practically impossible to time these things. And when something gains meme stock status, as this certainly has, it takes on a life of its own. We've seen that since 2021. You know, I mean, GameStop, AMC, those have certainly fallen out of fashion. But last year, the regional bank stocks became targets of meme traders. And we saw a similar cocktail of factors, options activity, tough to borrow, maybe a potential short squeeze, you know, all this retail buzz. And we've seen that these things can really change the fortunes of retailers, of banks, and now a presidential candidate. You know, this meme stock and how this pans out could have implications for the 2024 presidential election over the next few months, which is really wild.
It's all converging. Gunjan, thank you. Still ahead, it could be a long-awaited lifeline for President Biden, courtesy of the economy. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
We are concerned about the local economic impact with some 8,000 jobs directly associated with port activities.
That was Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg from the White House sharing an update on the Baltimore Bridge collapse. You heard him say what he thinks will be the impact locally. But experts say this is likely to be the most expensive marine disaster for insurers in history. It's not just the bridge, reportedly insured by Chubb, or the liability for the lives lost. The cargo ship is insured by a group of shippers that pool their risk, but only up to $10 million. And then reinsurers around the world will be responsible. What's more, with the Port of Baltimore out of commission and a major East Coast thoroughfare down, claims could come rolling in for business disruption. Everyone who was supposed to get cars or farm equipment. I mean, hypothetically, hotels that lose conference business or restaurants that lose customers could file claims. The CEO of Everest Group, a global insurance and reinsurance company, told me today the economic impact is likely to run into the billions of dollars. And then there's the issue of marine insurance, skyrocketing even more than it already has because of danger in the Red Sea. That increases shipping costs around the world, as do supply chain disruptions, which eventually get passed on to all of us. The consumers will see it. Meanwhile, the 2024 election is heating up, and in terms of the overall economy, things may be looking better for President Biden. According to CNBC's latest All-America survey, President Biden is now just 1 point below former President Donald Trump in terms of support. So for some context, in December, Biden trailed Trump by 6 points in this same survey. As part of the rise for President Biden appears to be closely tied to the economy. In terms of overall economic performance under President Biden, 37% say they approve of the job he's doing. And while that may not be a majority of support, it's up from 33% in December. And so is the economy starting to give a lift to the president? What could it mean for his reelection chances in November? Joining me now is former North Dakota Senator and University of Chicago Institute of Politics Director Heidi Heitkamp, and economic analyst and columnist at the American Enterprise Institute, James Pethakoukas. Both are CNBC contributors. Senator, I'll start with you. Why do you think, the president's been working on inflation, he's been working on lowering debt for students. Why has it taken this long for Americans to start appreciating that the president's trying?
I think it's going to be a long time trend line. When people feel more confident, more stable about their own personal financial situation, that's going to be reflected in the polls. And for a long time, people have said, oh, I feel good about my economy, my situation, but I think the national economy is poor. Now that's catching up. You see it in the Michigan Index of Consumer Sentiment. All of these indicators are positive, along with the stock market, which you didn't mention. But honestly, you live and die by the economy. If something happens, and you just had a great segment about the potential for an economic impact on the bridge, we'll see what happens in the next 5-6 months.
Well, and we heard Christopher Waller say, barring some unforeseen event that really makes things messed up, that he thinks that we could be too quick to start cutting rates. But he also talked about, James, the issue that the 3- and 6-month CPI, the numbers on inflation are giving him pause. Do you think that Americans are still feeling every time they go to buy eggs, certainly every time they go to pay a rent check, that they're still feeling the pinch?
Well, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, we had a huge inflation surge over a short period of time that wasn't that long ago. It's not like people have to look back a decade. People just have to look back to, 2020, 2021. They remember what eggs cost. They remember what bread costs. Those numbers are still very firm in people's minds. So they think that, wow, prices are still out of hand. Even if those price rises have minimized, even if we had disinflation, they remember the price surge. There's nothing he can do about that. And there's nothing the president can do about his age, which people are also concerned about. What he needs is month after month of real wage growth over the next 7 months. And as I've been saying on this show, if he gets that, and what looks to be a close election, that might be enough. But there's no room for error.
We often talk about the impact of gas prices on politics. And if you look at this year, wholesale gasoline is up 20%, 28% year to date. Of course, that translates to higher prices at the pump. The national average for gasoline right now is about $3.50 a gallon. That's according to AAA, 10 cents higher than a year ago and up 26 cents over just the last month. How much do gas prices still matter to how people vote, Heidi?
I think they matter a lot because they're an indicator of whether people feel like they can take a vacation, whether they have the wherewithal to actually get to work. But the bottom line is, this is about how people feel about the economy, how they feel about where they're at. And the one thing we haven't talked about is their 401ks look pretty good right now. Whether that's sustainable or not is a whole question. But, the former president used to brag about, look what I've done to the stock market. Well, the stock market is at record highs, and that makes people more comfortable about the retirement future.
The other thing that strikes me, James, is that we've seen a slew of Americans get new deals in the form form of union contracts that were hard fought and hard won. We've seen steady wage growth, steady employment. How much do jobs factor into how people are feeling about the economy?
Yeah, well I think we've seen like sort of a great experiment looking at sort of jobs versus inflation. Experiment we haven't had to run for a long time. And what we found out that is inflation really seems to matter more. Listen, even when the unemployment rate's, you know, 10%, 90% of people still have jobs. When inflation goes up, it affects everybody. And that's why that's been such a powerful factor. Now listen, the president needs the unemployment rate to stay steady, and he needs inflation to be below wage growth, no matter how that wage growth gets achieved, whether it's just through economic growth or union contracts, and he needs that growth to happen in those key swing states. If that can happen, I think we're still talking about an extraordinarily close election. But listen, people, it's like, what have you done for me lately? If people remember the last 6 or 7 months feeling good about the economy, that matters.
James Pethakoukas, Senator Heidi Heitkamp, thank you both for joining us. Thank you. Coming up, there are a lot of naysayers who just might be eating dust right now. What's really fueling a tear for shares of Detroit's Big Three? We have answers after this. Welcome back. It's been nearly 6 months since the UAW strike ended against Detroit's Big Three automakers. For their stocks, things are surprisingly great. The new UAW labor contracts have brought multi-billion dollar cost increases to the companies, but the automakers are outperforming the market since the end of the strike. Look at GM, up 64%. It hit a two-year high today. Stellantis up 60%. Ford up 31%. For some context, S&P 500 up 27%. So have the concerns over the UAW contract increases just been overblown? With me tonight for more, former Ford CEO, CNBC contributor Mark Fields. Well, have they? I mean, is share price commensurate with performance?
Well, I think, you know, Contessa, I think the market's waking up to the fact that the established automakers are pretty well positioned to ride out the transition to EVs over time. I mean, they have, you know, if you think about it, the market really fell in love with a lot of the new startups, the EV-only startups. They gave them huge valuations. Now what you're seeing is those companies can't execute on their business plans. They've been impacted by the slowdown in the adoption of EVs. And I think investors are waking up and they're looking at the automakers and they're saying, hey, listen, these established automakers have a lot of advantages, right? They have a strong ICE business or internal combustion business. You know, the domestic three are particularly strong in full-size pickup and large SUVs, which carry a lot of profit and margins. Folks like Ford have a very strong commercial business that cater to medium and sized fleets. And they also have a large install base, which drives a lot of parts and service profitability. So, you know, I think when you combine that with some of the announcements and the guidance that the domestic three gave, I think investors are waking up and saying, hey, even though these increased costs, labor costs, which are significant, it still is a pretty good time to be an established automaker, but they have challenges in front of them. There's no doubt about it.
The port that's affected by the bridge collapse in Baltimore is a major one for cars coming in. And we know that there's going to be an economic impact. We heard the transportation secretary talking about it and the CEO of Everest. I'm just curious, when you're looking at the potential for supply chain disruptions for the auto industry, for parts and everything that goes along with that, how much do you factor in what's going to come and how quickly that can turn on a dime?
Well, you know, with the advent of just-in-time inventory, clearly it's a lot faster. It could impact the industry than it did, let's say, 20 years ago. But when you think about the port in Baltimore, it is one of the major ports. It's actually, if it's not the first, it's the second largest port for imported vehicles. That being said, you know, the folks like Ford and GM, they might not be as impacted as much as some of the European brands like Volkswagen and others that import vehicles through there. Mm-hmm. So it could be an advantage. And in terms of parts, yes, it could be impacted if they're importing parts from places like Europe and Asia. But what you've seen in the auto industry over the last, you know, number of years, whether it's COVID or supply chain issues, et cetera, they have a way of coping. But if I had to put a wager on it, I'd say, you know, folks like Ford and GM could be impacted less than some of the other import brands.
Mark, it's great to see you. Thank you for joining us. Disney may be fighting wars on many fronts, but one battle's over. A truce has been reached. The company has agreed to settle a long-running lawsuit over control of Disney's special governing district that is home to Disney World in Orlando. The settlement paves the way for Disney to expand its theme park and resorts. Here's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
With all the Disney issues, parents' rights in education, replacing Reedy Creek and making sure that was a state control board, everything we've done has been in the best interest of the state of Florida. And we have been vindicated on all those actions. Going forward, we're going to continue to govern with the best interest of the state of Florida. So I'm glad that they were able to do that settlement.
The president of Walt Disney World in Florida released a statement saying, in part, "We are pleased to put an end to all pending litigation." So as the dust settles in Florida, Disney is on the brink of another battle ahead of the Disney shareholder meeting set to kick off 1 week from today. Joining me now is CNBC.com media reporter Alex Sherman. Let's start in Florida. What do you think is the impact of the fight that they had in the first place with DeSantis?
Yeah, look, this was obviously a political fight to some degree. I mean, Ron DeSantis was running for president. We know that. And he could use Disney as sort of this symbol of woke culture gone awry. Remember when this lawsuit began, it was right in the middle of Disney's response to his controversial Don't Say Gay legislation. From what I gathered, the reason the settlement happened now is there was a recent change in leadership at the board level there. A couple of the most antagonistic members toward Disney are no longer there. So that, I think, was a facilitator for a deal to get done. But also, Governor DeSantis isn't running for president anymore. And by the way, Disney is in the middle of this proxy fight. And settling this lawsuit may be one more box to check for their investors.
In fact, a story that we first brought viewers last night about Egan Jones saying Nelson Peltz should have a seat on the board, basically opposing Iger. Did the Disney war have anything to do with that?
You know, I happen to have the Egan Jones report right in front of me, Contessa. As it just so happens, I got my hands on this. Two bullet points for why they are not voting for the current Disney slate and why they are voting for Nelson Peltz stood out to me. One, a relationship with government which is at best neutral and at worst highly problematic, in parentheses, Florida. Two, the unnecessary and extremely dangerous entrance of the company and its management into the killing fields of the culture wars.
I mean, boy, those are some strong words.
So, look, settling this, you kind of do check off those boxes a week before this big annual meeting and this vote. So, you know, are these things connected? Maybe not. Is it fortuitous timing? It certainly seems like it.
It also goes on to say that the board appears to be cut off and unwilling to engage with investors and the broader market. How much lobbying do you anticipate is going to be happening this weekend ahead of that shareholder?
Yeah, I think it's been happening for the past month or so, really. March in particular, it's gone to, you know, turn the dial to 11 in terms of investor support. You see advertisements all over the place. They're popping up on social media and podcasts. Vote for Disney, vote for Trion. So I think it's going to reach a fever pitch this weekend. All the institutional investors will vote. And then I think, you know, the early into next week, that's when either side may start to get a sense of, okay, the vote is leaning one way or the other.
Egan Jones says that there's a desire to protect the status quo for as long as possible and at all costs. Does that affect succession?
Well, I think Bob Iger's would love to have control of the succession plan. I mean, it's one of the main reasons he came back was sort of to right the wrong of putting Bob Chapek in there, at least in his mind. So if Nelson Peltz is voted to the board,
yeah.
Nelson Peltz says, look, I'm a professional headhunter. I want to be a part of this. So for sure, I think there would be some tension there about Iger having full control over who takes over for him. Or maybe Peltz saying, wait a second here. You know, this is a board decision, not a Bob Iger decision. So let us have more of a say in this than maybe you want us to.
A lot of people thought that the board should have grabbed those reins long before they did. All right, Alex, thank you.
Yes.
Coming up, sportsbooks get clotheslined after a stunning demand from the NCAA. Huge implications for sports betting after this.
Being a change maker means embracing uncertainty to deliver outstanding performance. I think to do that, you've got to start with curiosity. Be curious about the challenges in front of you. You then got to have the commitment to go the long haul to do that. It often requires partnership to come up with creative solutions. And lastly, it requires agility to pivot when you need to.
Americans are expected to wager more than $2.7 billion on March Madness. But the NCAA is pushing back hard today against some types of bets offered on both the men's and the women's tournaments. Today, the organization publicly urged states with legalized sports betting to ban prop bets in college sports. In this case, prop bets are wagers on individual athletes' performance. For example, people can bet on whether Iowa superstar Caitlin Clark will score over or under 32.5 points in her next game. NCAA President Charlie Baker issued a statement. Sports betting issues are on the rise across the country, with prop bets continuing to threaten the integrity of competition and leading to student athletes getting harassed. Who's harassing athletes? Come on, you guys. Shares of DraftKings and Flutter, which owns FanDuel, got hit hard following the news. DraftKings off by more than 6%. The NCAA already has made some progress in pushing for the ban of prop bets on college athletes. Among the 38 states which have legalized sports betting, 22 of them, though, still allow college prop bets. However, some of those states do not allow bets on college players from in-state schools. Lots of varying regulations. Well, as the NCAA goes after prop bets, the old bracket betting is getting a big boost, and investors are starting to look to monetize the ways that Americans bet with their friends.
I'm very excited about March Madness.
19-year-old Chase Lavasser loves sports. He's too young legally to gamble in his home state of Massachusetts, but he gets a fix with his friends on Fliff.
You're using a fake currency that you turn back into cash if you win, hopefully. But Fliff does it so you can see, like, your friends' rankings, and you can look at how, what your friends are betting on.
Fliff advertises as free to play, though there's an opportunity to buy Fliff coins and potentially win cash. It's a sweepstakes model that skirts most states' gambling regulations. Age limit, 18 and older.
I live in a house here at Dartmouth College with 15 other guys, and it's constantly just the sports are on. We're talking about what picks are being made.
The business potential there is obvious to Dartmouth students Carson Hubbard and Bella DiGiovanni, ages 20 and 21 years old. They just launched a new business.
Welcome to Rebet, the first of its kind free-to-play social sports book.
We saw that there was this major void in the current sports betting experience.
For one thing, the sports betting lingo is a lot of jargon.
And that's a big barrier to entry for females to this industry. So with that creation of that, those easy-to-read lines that we have, we're hoping to not only target females, target all beginner bettors, but we do want to hit on that untapped market.
In daily fantasy sports, friends have been competing for decades, and newcomers, Prize Picks and Underdog, are making waves in the space.
Welcome to the Blackjack Table.
More broadly, the category of social casino, that is, playing for free, maybe for prizes or rewards, is estimated at roughly $6 billion annually, tiny compared to the $110 billion in gambling revenue across the United States last year. But players say the social games are accessible, affordable, and most importantly, fun.
It's more competitive with your friends rather than just money.
Where's the investment opportunity in social sports betting? Let's ask Lloyd Danzig. He's a managing partner at Sharp Alpha Advisors. It's a venture capital firm specializing in sports, gaming, and entertainment. Where do you think this is going?
Thanks, Contessa. It's great to be here. I think one of the most important things to recognize is that there's a different sociocultural orientation towards sports betting in the U.S. compared to almost anywhere else in the world. You go to a physical sports book anywhere in Europe, and what you'll see is something reminiscent of a post office, or what was once described to me as the physical embodiment of a spreadsheet. It's a transactional and utilitarian location. Whereas at a Las Vegas sportsbook, for most customers, the betting odds are one of the least important facets of the experience. It's a social and entertainment destination. And we see these cultural leanings bear themselves out in the data. DraftKings, FanDuel, MGM combined, as well as the rest of the sports betting operators, have maybe 10 million unique monthly active users right now. But 68 million Americans are expected to bet just on March Madness alone. And so the industry is starting to learn that they cannot overlook this more recreational social leaning customer who classifies psychologically their expenses as deposits, not as capital.
We saw the NCAA president come out today against prop bets because of the pressure that it puts on athletes and because of issues. I mean, some of the issues that are surrounding the Toronto Raptors player right now have to do with the crazy amounts of money that were put on crazy prop bets on Jontay Porter. When you look at the potential for backlash, the integrity questions, when you look at Fliff's, I mean, Fliff will say we don't market to children, but they have animated, they have animations on their platform that look super fun. And the kids that are 18 and over like being on there. Do you think there's likely to be a regulatory headwind that state gaming regulators are going to say, wait a minute, this should fall under our purview?
You know, when we study real money gaming markets that are more mature internationally, what we see is that every single one of them at some point stumbled in the face of public backlash pertaining to responsible gaming. And so the hope is that market leaders here in the U.S. have taken those lessons and oriented themselves toward the belief that responsible gaming truly is sustainable gaming, not just in relation to specific users, but the freedom of movement of the industry as a whole.
The news that I broke this morning on Squawk Box was about a new trade group. Seven of the biggest online gambling platforms say they're going to come together and share information on problem gambling and problem gamblers. Is that real? Can that make a difference?
Hard to say specifically, only time will tell, but I do believe that the socially conscious and long-term profit-maximizing routes are the same here, and that operators truly are incentivized to make sure not just that individual customers, but the business as a whole is sustainable, and implementing short-term responsible gaming mechanisms is one of the best ways to do that.
Thank you for coming into studio.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the true cost of charging an EV, a new report you want to see next. If you own an electric vehicle, there's a good chance you charge your car at home. According to a J.D. Power survey, 83% of EV owners regularly do. But do you know how much money you're saving or could save? My next guest is one of those EV owners and says despite a hefty front-end investment, there is long-term cost savings. Wall Street Journal's Joanna Stern here to break it down for us. So you did the math about your EV. What did you learn?
I learned that I'm saving about half the amount that I would if I was using gas. And that's actually what's going on around the country, that people who are charging at home are spending about or are saving about half they would of what they would have spent on gas.
So you spend $125 on electricity and you drive 2,500 miles. And how did you go about factoring what that would have been had you had an internal combustion car?
Right. That's the tough part about the math, is that there isn't the equivalent. I have a Mustang Mach-E, and that there isn't quite the exact equivalent of a gas-powered car. I do, though, I do have data on based on what I used to spend on my previous cars and what I currently have as another gas car in my family. And when I look at what I'm spending for that other gas-powered car in New Jersey, where, you know, about depending on the pricing, but right now $3 a gallon, and I compare that to what I'm paying in my house, it is about half of what I'm paying per kilowatt per hour in terms of electricity.
How much did you pay to have the special outlet?
So this is where the cost kind of gets a little bit muddy. I paid for the specific outlet, both the electrician install and the actual charger, about $1,500. But what I found out when reporting this story, and this is where the EV industry is doing not a very good job, and the utility industry isn't doing a very good job, is telling people about rebates, subsidies, and other places they can get that money back. So it turns out 6 months later, as I'm doing this reporting, I realized, hey, I can actually get back a good chunk of that money. I already got a rebate back for $250 on the charger itself, which costs $500.
And if you have to like park in a garage with charging, like in New York City, or you spend a lot of time charging your car at the gas station, would you still save the money?
This is where it really gets complicated. it is best if you're home charging. It is the best advantage if you're home charging. If you are charging at Tesla superchargers or other third-party public EV chargers, the price goes up considerably. And part of that is the speed. You will charge much faster at a faster charger from Tesla or from an EVgo than you will be able to do in your house. But when you're at home and you're sleeping at night, it's okay. My car is charging in the garage. I'm not going to be using that. But when I'm on the road and I'm on a road trip and I want to charge real quick, right? It's going to take a little bit longer than it would take to get gas, and it's going to cost more.
The best place to charge? At work, when your boss is paying for it. That's what happens at CNBC. At least I've heard. Joanna, thank you. And thank you so much for watching Last Call tonight. Shark Tank is up next. Enjoy your Wednesday.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Nexto, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Nexto, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.